listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And a lot to talk about. Remember back in January 20th, 2009, when 14 Republican leaders of Congress got together to sabotage the president? Pete Sessions was one of them. He's got some really interesting things to say today. We're going to get into that. We were talking about broadband in Chattanooga, Tennessee yesterday. Guess what? Something's going on in Kansas, and it has to do with Alec and the Koch brothers. And you need to know about that. Elizabeth Warren has some ideas for the post office that are fascinating. Governor Siegelman is still in prison. Go to free-don.org. A lot going on. And C. Edmund Wright is on the line with us. He is a conservative commentator, contributor to Breitbart and American Thinker, author of WTF, How Karl Rove and the Establishment Lost Again. His website, C. Edmund Wright, WRIGHT.com. May I speak to you informally? And if so, how should I do so, sir?
Is Edmund informal enough?
Edmund is fine. I didn't know. Some people would say C or, Ed or Edmund. Okay. Edmund, thanks for joining. You've been on the show enough times. I feel like I should call you by your first name.
You should. And it's Edmund with a U, which I don't know why everyone wants to put an O in it. Almost no one who has the name puts an O in it, but everyone else does.
Yeah.
Right?
And so
not
for,
important.
And well, it is important if you're trying to get to the website of cedmundwright.com or the Twitter feed of @cedmundwright. Yeah. 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 So the topic that Sean put down on my one sheet here is that a conservative defends the 1%.
I don't know that I would say that's what I'm doing because, a lot of those 1%,
Are you one of the 1%, if you don't mind my asking?
Pardon me, say again, Tom?
And feel free to say it's none of my business, and I won't push any farther, but are you part of the 1%?
No, a couple years ago I was pretty close, but no, I've actually moved further away from that now, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, the same is true of me, and although I'm sure I'm probably in the top 5%, but why would anybody who is not in the 1% be out there defending the 1% when we've got, the 1% own more wealth than the bottom half of America? I mean,
yes. First of all, I would never defend the 1% per se, but what I would do is, first of all, I would cut the 1% out and say, on the one hand, you got, say, Steve Jobs and the people at Microsoft and so on, the CEO of Walmart. And their producers, and fine, that's 1%. They earned their way. On the other hand,
Wait a minute.
Can I make one more point?
You may, but I want to come back to that because I don't think that most of these people earned their way. But go for it.
Well, and the other side of that is, I would say that the 1% of the people who took all the money and bankrupted Solyndra, that's a totally different deal. So I would say I would attack that second group. At the drop of a hat, and have so how you
so you're opposed to Jamie Dimon, to all the people who took the government bailouts, Jamie Dimon, all the big banks, all this stuff. All these Wall Street
problem.
Billionaires.
Big problem.
Yeah. Okay. I think we have a consensus on that. But back to the we were telling the old Pete Seeger story a couple of days ago about a fly who laid a couple of eggs and they got caught by the wind and one landed on a dusty street and the other landed on a dead cat. And they hatched into maggots, and a week or so later, the maggot that was on the dusty street is just kind of struggling to get by, and he runs into this fat, happy maggot who'd landed on the dead cat and says, boy, how'd you get so strong and healthy? And the maggot who had landed on the dead cat, whose egg had landed on the dead cat, says, hard work and perseverance, young man.
Analogy to bring it full. I mean, did Steve Jobs land on the dead cat, or did he actually go change?
He landed on the dead cat. He was the product of an upper middle class family. Had Steve Jobs grown up in Watts, he would not have even had a garage with his home. He wouldn't have had the educational opportunities. He wouldn't have had the family opportunities. He wouldn't
He flunked out of college as a freshman. He didn't have any great educational opportunities.
He didn't flunk out. He dropped out, and he had the ability to have access to the equipment that he did.
Yeah.
Because of his parents' income, because his parents were probably in the top 5%.
I understand that.
And the same is true of Bill Gates. I've talked to Bill Gates' father, or actually his writing partner, Chuck Collins, and Bill Gates grew up in a fairly wealthy family. I mean, these guys, you know, this idea that anybody can make it. I mean, you occasionally somebody rises up out of the slums, but, you know, Calcutta and Bombay, the slums of Calcutta and Bombay are probably not going to produce the next Einstein. Or the next Steve Jobs, for that matter. And beyond that, I would say, you know, Steve Jobs, he's engaged in a lot of illegal behavior that's now coming to light. You know, these various tech companies conspiring with each other not to hire each other's employees and thus drive up the cost of labor. The patent and copyright laws. Steve Jobs basically got the idea from it was the Star operating system. What company was that? Hewlett Packard, was it? Or it was one of the other companies. And that was actually an operating system that had been developed by the U.S. government. And Bill Gates is, you know, probably the biggest welfare queen in America. If it wasn't for the copyright and trademark laws, I'm not buying it. This is not hard work and perseverance. And there's nobody in this country who's working so hard that they're worth $2 billion a year. And yet you've got a dozen people on Wall Street who made that last year, each one of them.
Well, and again, I would say that Wall Street hasn't been free enterprise in many years. Wall Street is not where I would go to defend the 1%, because Wall Street is very much a crony industry more than it is a free enterprise.
But almost without exception, the 1% are coming out of industries that have engaged in regulatory capture.
Let's talk. Can we go about down to maybe 2-3%? Because I think when you get down there, you capture a lot of guys who started home building companies and landscape companies.
I got no problem with the top 3%. You know, people who are making over, what is that, $250,000, $300,000 a year, something like that.
Yeah, that's probably about where that comes in. Okay, maybe the 1% or certainly the 0.1%. Yeah, that's a different deal, and there's a lot of, you know, there's some success stories there, but there's a lot of crony connections there.
And there's a lot of, you know, Koch brothers inheriting, you know, money from their father who made his fortune with Joe Stalin. I mean, it's like, that's, which is a kind of strange story. Although apparently it informed his helping start the John Birch Society. I mean, maybe there's a high integrity story there. Who knows? But it's still, you know, these people who were born on what's the old joke that Ann Richards
born
made about George?
Base, yeah.
Yeah, born on third base and thought he hit a triple.
Yeah.
I think Americans increasingly are.
I would go back, Tom. I would want to know who hit the first single and the first double and the first triple that allowed the people to be born on third base. So, you know, I would be more interested in the story of the generation that got to third base.
Well, or how about having a society where that, actually, we're talking not about third base, we're talking about 3,000th base. I mean, you know, is it right that the Walton heirs in aggregate would be the richest person on earth, these five people? And that their wealth is added to the tunes of hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars a year by a business practice that causes all of us to pay, you know, welfare to the tune of about $1 million per Walmart
store. Well, I
don't
know that it causes that. By the way, I'm not a huge fan of Walmart, and they give more money to Democrats and Republicans now, and they know who their shopper base is, and they know what they need to do. But I would say this, you know, the Waltons created a lot of millionaires from dirt poor people.
No, Sam did. But when Sam left and they started importing stuff from China, when Sam died, they've made a lot of billionaires in China.
Store managers and stuff too with stock options. So.
Okay. C. Edmund Wright. Hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
CEdmundWright.com is the website, spelled with a U and a W. And thank you, sir. Good to talk with you, Edmund. Well, not the fieriest debate I've ever had, but interesting conversation. Anyhow, Andrew Campbell is with us, senior producer of The Big Picture. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure, Andrew. The CBO report, this Fox News yesterday, breathless. we're discovering Obamacare is more of a disaster than we thought. Oh, my God. We're going to open with that.
Yeah, and you actually you talked about it on your radio show yesterday as well. Mm-hmm. What the report basically says is thanks to Obamacare, people are going to have the option to work less and not work full-time jobs because they'll have access to health insurance, which is something that part-time workers have not had in the past.
Right.
And with that comes a bunch of other great benefits for the country, so we'll be getting into that.
Yeah, very good. And Lone Liberal Rumble, Chris Ullman and Horace Cooper are going to drop by, the dynamic duo.
Yeah, so it should be a pretty fiery rumble.
We'll
start off with the CBO report, and then we'll get into the RNC's new push to highlight, and I quote, Republican trailblazers that are black. But is this more for tokenism than anything else? We'll get into that.
Right.
We'll talk about a new World Health Organization report that says regulations are the key to fighting obesity and combating the epidemic in the U.S., where, I mean, it's a huge problem with our children. It's a huge problem with adults. It's just it's a real epidemic and a real problem here.
Yeah, you know, for that tokenism discussion, let's be sure that there's a question in there that points out the Southern strategy and that points out Reagan's speech. And the real question is this tokenism. The real question is, has the Republican Party really decided to set aside 50 or 60 years of, or however many years it's been since Nixon was elected in 68, that many years of fairly explicit race-baiting policies in order to win elections?
Sounds good.
Okay, thank you.
Then from there, we're going to talk about the Keystone, and obviously the report came out recently, and we'll be continuing to hammer your thoughts that if this is so important to us to get this gas and tar sands oil from Canada, why can't it just be refined up there so Americans aren't forced to deal with the consequences?
Right, so we don't have to take the poison. We'll buy the gasoline. You guys can keep the poison.
Yep.
Yeah,
exactly.
Okay.
Then we'll end up with a discussion on GM, its new CEO, Mary Barra, who was highlighted in the President's State of the Union, is only making a fraction of what her predecessor made, who was a male, Dan Akerson. So we'll be getting into why there's that disparity and right. The uproar that's been caused because of it.
Okay, and then we're going to talk about the future of fish.
Yep, there's new information out about an update to previous reports that we could see saltwater fish extinction before 2048. We'll talk about the ramifications of that and why and how climate change is behind that.
That's what's called an extinction.
Yeah, exactly. Yep, scary stuff.
Yeah, it is. It is. Okay, and what else?
And then in Block D, we have our daily take, and we'll be talking about CVS's decision to stop selling tobacco products and get into really the purposes of taxation. I mean, everyone thinks it's just to collect money, but there's other reasons that items and things are taxed, and we'll talk about that.
Very good. Andrew Campbell, the senior producer of The Big Picture, I will see you tonight, Andrew.
Thanks, Tom.
And The Big Picture, of course, runs at 7 o'clock Eastern time. You can calculate local time right here on Free Speech TV and as well as on the RTTV network. We'll be right back. Up and new in the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. And remember back in 2009, on the evening that Barack Obama and his wife, Michelle, and Joe Biden and his wife, Jane, isn't it? Jill. I always mix up those two names. Jill Biden were dancing at, well, there were five or six or seven balls here in Washington, D.C. Ellen Ratner and I went to the one here at Union Station. And, you know, we were dancing with the Bidens and dancing with the Obamas, and it was so cool, and we were having such a great time. And little did we know that just 20 blocks away, not even that. I mean, I used to walk it every morning when Louise and I lived in an apartment building at the corner of 8th and D and the backside, the corner of 9th and D, right across from the J. Edgar Hoover FBI building, is this restaurant called the Caucus Room. And they have a private room in the back. And that private room was occupied by 14 Republican leaders, plus Frank Luntz and and Newt Gingrich. And these guys, while we were dancing with the Obamas, the night that he was inaugurated in 2009, this was January 20th, 2009, his first day as president, his first 6 hours as president, President Obama, Eric Cantor, Paul Ryan, Kevin McCarthy, Pete Sessions, Jeb Hensarling, Dan Lundgren, Jim DeMint, who now runs the Heritage Foundation, John Kyle, Tom Coburn, John Ensign, and Bob Corker were meeting and plotting how to make the Obama presidency a failed presidency. You will recall Pete Sessions in March, that was January, February, March, so 2.5 months later, said to the National Journal, and I quote, you know, and this is like basically, here's how we're going to do this. Now, keep in mind, on January 20th, 2009, that was the 20th day of a month in which we lost 750,000 American jobs. We were sliding into what could have been the second Great Depression within 100 years. We had lost 750,000 jobs that month. And Pete Sessions said that basically we got to follow the model of the Taliban to take down Obama. And you say, Taliban? Pete Sessions said Taliban? Really? You got to be exaggerating. No. This is what he said to the National Journal, and I quote, Taliban insurgency. We understand perhaps a little more because of the Taliban. Insurgency is the way they went about systematically understanding how to disrupt and change a person's entire processes. And these Taliban is an example of how you go about to change a person from their messaging to their operations to their frontline message. And we need to understand that insurgency may be required when dealing with the other side. The other side, of course, being the Obama administration and the Democrats. He went on to say, and this is in the National Journal, if the Democrats do not give us those options or opportunities, then we will become insurgency. I think insurgency is a mindset and an attitude that we're going to have to search for and find ways to get our message out and be prepared to see things for what they are rather than trying to do something about them. Really? Kevin McCarthy, at the meeting, said, we got to challenge him on every single bill. We have to show united and unyielding opposition to the president's economic policies. Now, these were guys who all voted yes to bailing out Bear Stearns, to bailing out AIG, to both Bush and Cheney tarps, and to the Bush-Cheney stimulus bill in January 2008. Obama comes in? No. Just Jim DeMint, John Kyle, Tom Coburn, John Ensign, and Bob Coburn, just those five senators have filibustered over 300 bills. They voted no on every major piece of legislation that came to the floor, including Al Franken's anti-rape amendments, Lilly Ledbetter, the No Fair Pay Act, the anti-outsourcing bill. This is from a great post by Keep 'Em Honest over at the Daily Kos, titled Eric Cantor, Paul Ryan, and Kevin McCarthy Plot to Sabotage U.S. Economy with Frank Luntz, from Friday of June 8th of 2012. They even voted no on FEMA. Funding FEMA. Okay, so with that background, here comes this story today. The headline is Congressman. Extending the social safety net for long-term unemployed is immoral. Who would that congressman be? Well, as Alan Pike writes for the Center for American Progress's blog, thinkprogress.org, it is immoral to extend a meager monthly allowance to unemployed Americans still looking for work more than 6 months after losing their jobs, according to Congressman Pete Sessions. Which is why he and his fellow House conservatives are blocking Democrats' efforts to reinstate the safety net program. He said, now keep in mind, this is the guy who swore he would do everything he could. He would become the Taliban to mark Obama as a bad president, to make the Obama presidency fail. He said yesterday, quote, I believe it is immoral for this country to have a policy extending long-term unemployment benefits to people rather than us working on the creation of jobs. Right. And you really are going to make the government the employer of last resort, Mr. Sessions? I don't think so. 1.3 million people have lost their long-term unemployment benefits since Christmas. And it's going to be another, you know, and they have 2.3 million children who are now in households that can't pay for food or heat. He says, self-respect is what makes jobs important. Right. So let's see. Reagan said, if we cut taxes on the rich, they'll get richer and that'll trickle down to the rest of us. And it'll create jobs. And we cut taxes over and over and over again. And every time we cut taxes, where are the jobs, Mr. Sessions? And are you still playing that role?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
You know, that role that Alexander Hamilton or Thomas Jefferson would have called treason? Are you still doing that, Congressman Sessions? Just following up on a little of the news over the last few days. You know, this song America the Beautiful that was played during the Coca-Cola ad. I mean, first of all, I got some problems with Coca-Cola, with their business practices, with their bait and switch, the whole new Coke thing back in the 80s, I think it was, where they, you know, they switched from sugar to high fructose corn syrup because, you know, government subsidies to the corn industry and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, if you want sugar in your Coke, you got to buy it from Mexico. And even that, I mean, you know, their use of fresh water, et cetera, and some of their other beverages. I could give you a, you know, but hey, you know, what they're doing is legal and they're making money. And they wanted to reach out to people and, you know, with more of this, we want the world to sing kind of thing. And so they had America the Beautiful sung in all these different languages by people of different races and apparently religions. And the right wingers freaked out. You know, like the America the Beautiful, this is like an iconic song, you know, the America the Beautiful. I mean, this is like America, you know, it's like multiculturalism. Oh, my God, that's a horrible thing. Somebody call them up and let them know that Catherine Lee Bates, who wrote America the Beautiful, was a radical lesbian. She was in the suffrage movement. She was outspoken. She was an author. She was up. She was out. She was. That's amazing. For 25 years, she lived in what was called a Boston marriage, which is like, you know, kind of, you know, openly gay, but not quite. And it wasn't until she died that her partner published a book that told about their relationship. But America the Beautiful. These conservatives, it's just bizarre. It's just bizarre. Okay, the other thing that I told you about yesterday at some length was how Chattanooga, Tennessee, and two other American cities are offering, you know, this gigabyte broadband service to their residents. And, you know, this is really cool. You've got a city in Virginia, a city in, I think it was North Carolina, that's doing this. And, you know, cities around the country are starting to say, hey, this is amazing. You know, why don't we create a public utility too and offer really, really, really fast broadband to everybody? It'll stimulate the economy of the city. It'll stimulate innovation. It'll cause internet entrepreneurs to either start growing here or moving here. So what's the response? The state of Kansas. I'm not making this up. Remember Thomas Frank wrote a book called What's the Matter with Kansas? The state of Kansas is considering legislation that says, and I quote, except with regard to unserved areas, a municipality may not directly or indirectly. May not. A municipality, a town cannot. One, offer to provide to one or more subscribers video, telecommunications, or broadband service. Or two, purchase, lease, construct, maintain, or operate any facility for the purpose of enabling a private business or entity to offer, provide, carry, or deliver video, telecommunications, or broadband service to one or more subscribers. So basically, you know, what Kansas is saying is we ain't going to have no Chattanooga here. We're going to make, if a city in Kansas, is Kansas City in Kansas? It's in Missouri, isn't it? Yeah, okay. What's the capital of Kansas? Topeka. Thank you, Shano. Did you learn all the capitals when you were in? Yeah, okay. I'm impressed. I skipped that, or I flunked that test or whatever. But in any case, they're basically saying, unless the town has no internet access whatsoever, in which case they may be able to do something. But, you know, the cities in Kansas cannot do what Chattanooga did. We're going to forbid it by law. KansasCity.com, the Kansas City Star. Cable providers want unfair playing field in Kansas. Senate Bill 304, initiated by the cable industry. Surprise! Surprise! The bill initiated by the cable industry aims to bar cities and counties from starting their own broadband or TV services. It would also likely stop cities from partnering with private businesses like Google to create broadband or TV networks. I wrote about this. It's over at alternet.org right now. And it's amazing. You know, one of the responses from people was, well, you know, Google is coming in with high-speed internet. Yeah. Google, who tracks absolutely everything you do, now they can track it faster. This is why I use DuckDuckGo as my .com as my search engine, because they don't track what you're doing. It's amazing. Every now and then, I will search something on Google, or even search something on Google, and then I find ads for that thing. I've had this happen like three times in the last week. The one that was the weirdest was our cat Fang was losing, had a little spot near his tail where he was losing some hair. And I thought, geez, I wonder if that's like, you know, some kind of an infection or something. I started Googling that. And what popped up was that cats can have ringworm, which is just a fungus infection, actually. And so I Googled cat ringworm and found out that probably Fang did not have cat ringworm and symptoms weren't the same. He probably just, you know, backed up to a fan or something. Who knows? But for the next like 4 days, every computer I was on, wherever I was, whether it was here in the radio studio or in the TV studio, and this, I did this Googling at home. Because ringworm is a fungus, these god awful ads for toenail fungus were popping up on my screen with these pictures of these orange, grotesque toenails. Got toenail fungus? Well, no, I don't, and I never have. And I wasn't Googling that, but, you know, I guess fungus is fungus. And I'm like, you know, don't look over my shoulder, please. This is going to gross you out. And thank God I wasn't, you know, Googling, I don't know, sexual enhancement or something, make it longer or whatever. I mean, you know, it's like we're all gay porn, straight porn. I mean, you fill in the blanks, right? What might you Google that is going to haunt you? And you might be Googling it for your term paper, or in our case, I mean, we Google all sorts of, or we search for all sorts of weird stuff for this show. And you wouldn't believe the ads that all of us end up with. And it's like, this is just, you know, this should be opt-in, not opt-out. You know, there's a couple of sites that where I buy things on the internet, and I frankly don't mind if they keep track of what I bought from them, because particularly with books, you know, I've got a couple of favorite authors, John D. MacDonald, Robert B. Parker, Rex Stout. This is what I read for just like brain dead entertainment, put myself to sleep. And if there's an author who's writing in that style and that genre, and a lot of people who bought those books are also buying those books, I would like to know that. I got no problem with that. But that's a whole different thing from a search engine looking at absolutely everything I'm doing. And even, but frankly, even that, I mean, even on Amazon or on the Apple Store or whatever, it should be opt-in, not opt-out. Yes, please track what I'm doing and provide me with better service. Or no, mind your own business. And the folks who are in the comments on the alternate article are saying, well, you know, Google is going to be offering, you know, really, really fast. You know, they're really just, well, of course. I mean, what's happened is that because we have basically cable TV companies and telephone companies, old line monopolies, Verizon, Comcast, AT&T, they're trying to run, you know, hey, you want high-speed internet? That's 20 MIPS. Really? What about a gigabyte? Or a gigabit? I don't know if it's bytes or bits, you know, which is an 8-to-1 difference, but it's still 1,000 versus 20. But a private company, I mean, they're going to get their pound of flesh one way or another. They're going to get their pound of flesh. You got to add to Sergey Brin's billions. I mean, they had to figure out a way to make more money for the CEO and the stockholders. That's their job. But if a city wants to provide this, they should be able to. I wonder if Alec has their fingers all.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Heck, I would bet that Alec has model legislation that says that you can't have broadband in your town. Oh, in fact, according to Alec Exposed, this is Alec model legislation. So it'll be coming to a state near you. Amazing. Amazing. Steve in Rochester, New York, you don't think people should get paid vacation? Really? Why is that? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV, by the way.
Oh, okay, Tom. That isn't the point. You can give people vacations. That isn't going to bother me. But I think the point is that if I was running a business and I had, let's say, 500 employees,
right,
and you're going to make me give them a certain amount of vacation.
Right.
I assume I'd already be giving them some, but you're going to give them more. I'm going to go get more robots. So what this vacation law is going to do is...
Steve, you've never run a business.
Getting more robots.
You've never run a business.
What?
You've never run a business. If you'd ever run a business, you would know that you would get the more robots to begin with. You know,
in this day and age, you most likely
The very first thing you're going to do is try to reduce your costs as much as you possibly can. And if there is any possibility that any of your employees can be replaced by robots, it's not going to take an increase in the minimum wage or more vacation hours for you to do that. You're going to do that, you know, job one, and take that money yourself. I mean, this is American business.
I never ran a business. And that could be most likely false. In fact, it is. But the point is that you said that, you know, this vacation law has gone through. Well,
no, it hasn't.
You know, starting from this point, now, if I was in business and it's running, okay, I'm retired, so I don't have to sweat this. But if I was running, if it was working now, you know, I got a business and it's operating. All of a sudden, the state comes in and starts telling me stuff that I should be doing as a moral person.
In exchange for all the tax benefits that you're getting as a business, in exchange for your free use of the court system that I'm paying for with my income tax as a corporation, in exchange for limitations of liability that you're getting, yes, we the people have a right to say to you, if you are going to do business and you're going to get all these benefits and you're going to be able to pay yourself with dividends at a maximum 20% income tax rate, then in exchange for that, you are going to conduct your business in a way that is consistent with the good of society. And if that means paying a minimum wage, it means paying a minimum wage. And if that means giving people a week of vacation pay after they've worked for 6 months, then it means giving people a week of vacation pay. And if you can't run your business on those terms, then you have no right running a business.
You didn't hear me, what I said. I said I think morally I'm obligated to pay a people a living wage. And if I'm, I've got some morals about things. People should have a minimum a wage to live on.
Right.
People should have a vacation.
Okay, but so you're saying you're a moral guy, but you're arguing on behalf of the immoral guys.
You get more progress by getting people to have some morals and to do something.
I agree with you, Steve, and I think the places like Costco are great examples of that, and most of America's small businesses, frankly, are examples of that. But the immoral people who are running the very large corporations in America, who are screwing their employees, are the people that you're arguing on behalf of when you say that we shouldn't have laws that mandate vacations or minimum wage. 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, the place where despair is not an option. And assuming everything works out right, and, there's Senate schedules and stuff going on and things like that, but Bernie's not going to be around on Friday to do brunch with Bernie. So in all probability, 10 minutes from now or 15 minutes from now, Bernie will be taking your calls. We'll be doing our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie, on what day is today? Tuesday? Wednesday. On Wednesday. And instead of on Friday. But the second hour is when we have our news report from the Talk Radio News Service. So right now, Bob Nay with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, was kind enough to come in an hour early and tell us what's going on in the world. Bob Nay, the author, by the way, of Sideswiped, the book to buy and read to learn what's going on in Washington, D.C., and what crimes John Boehner committed that could actually get him put in prison. Hey, Bob.
Hello, how are you? You have the expert coming on next hour, Senator Sanders.
Yes, he really is.
He's a good guy.
Yeah, and he just takes calls from our listeners and viewers for an hour, and he is so no BS. He is just such a straight shooter.
Great.
So, what's going on in the world, Bob?
Well, the farm bill is on its way to the president, and it's not really this mega bill, and it's $1 trillion and 5 years in the making, but it's more of a kind of a food bill. It sets up also some farming policies and what you'll know about some of the products, and the government does dramatically change about 75, 80 years of the subsidies. Not completely, but it changes some of it. The other, the president's not completely happy with the bill, but he's gonna sign it, and could have been more in it, could have been less, but
they're cutting food stamps by $8 billion, aren't they?
That's the problem, and I think the White House will not be as worried about that, frankly, because at the end of the day, they can't let the people run out of food stamps. I mean, they could, but I think the pressure would be absolutely enormous. So I.
Well, that's what they said about unemployment back in December, and now we are 3 weeks into people, not being able to pay their electric bills or their rent.
Well, that's true, and of course the food stamps is in the entitlement side, and then the unemployment, unfortunately, although they are trying to do something as we speak, they have a 3-month extension, which is what the Republicans wanted. So Senator Reid said you wanted it, and you wanted it paid for, and they have a kind of a pension smoothing, they're calling it, Tom,
right,
which I honestly can't figure out the details of.
Yeah.
But so I think he's calling the bluff of the Republicans. Now it's up to them whether they're going to provide the 60 to help with the 60 cloture vote the Senate has.
Right.
Kind of archaic rule that they've got. So
in other words, the question is: will the Republicans filibuster the extension of unemployment benefits that the Democratic senator from Rhode Island, Jack Reed?
That's right.
Has put forward.
The point Senator Reid, the head of the Senate, is making is, okay, you wanted 3 months, you have 3 months. You wanted it paid for, it's paid for.
Yeah.
So So I don't know what excuse the Republican side will have.
Well, they actually, it came out just a little bit ago. Pete Sessions, who was, you know, part of that caucus room conspiracy,
right,
and later on told the National Journal that they had decided that they were going to take lessons from the Taliban to take down the Obama administration, to destroy the Obama administration. Pete Sessions, either yesterday or this morning, said, quote, "I believe it is immoral for this country to have a policy extending long-term unemployment benefits to people." And he said that, actually he said that yesterday on the House floor in response to questions about why they were refusing to extend them. He says it's immoral.
I don't know how they must have areas where everybody's working. I don't know. I don't understand where they're coming from.
Yeah,
and you know, speaking on the lines of unemployment, I mean, this is the biggie today, and you want to talk about something that has been absolutely twisted around, as I know you've covered this, but the 2.5 million people, quote, who will exit the workforce for Obamacare.
Mm-hmm.
And I think coming to light of day is that the CBO report has to be taken for the speculation that it provides out there, but it has just been...
This is a good thing. This is a good thing. What this means is that 2.5 million people, actually it's going to be more like, you know, 5 or 6 million people, with the consequence to the total number of hours equal to around 2.5 million people, who are working 40-hour weeks and their kids are coming home to an empty house, but they have to work the 40-hour weeks to get the insurance. They're going to be able to say, you know, I'd rather leave at 3 p.m. and be there when my kids get home, and because I don't need your insurance anymore. Or people stuck in dead end jobs are going to be able to say, you know, this job sucks and I don't like the pay, and I was only here for the insurance, so I'm going to leave. And what that's going to do is tighten up the labor. First of all, it's going to make people happier. You're going to see less divorce, less child abuse, less, you know, use of tranquilizers, less use of speed to get through the day, whatever. And secondly, it's as you know, people leaving the job market, it doesn't mean that unemployment's going to change. You still have millions and millions of unemployed people ready and willing to jump in and take those jobs. But what it's going to mean is as the market tightens up, as the number of people looking for work tightens up, that wages go up. And when wages go up, the economy gets stimulated. The economy gets stimulated. The tax collections go up, and actually more jobs get created.
I think there's some benefits. It's just that the media headlines were that, you know, this bill throws them out of work. This will be their
option. That's crazy. Yeah.
And choice to be able to, you know, to do some things and actually insure their children. Maybe if they have some problem now medically and they're paying $1,700 a month, they don't have to do that anymore.
Right. Plus, they can go home early if they want, or, you know, they can get. I mean, there's a lot of people. I there was a study done about a year ago, and I think it was something like, you know, 30-some-odd percent of American workers are in a job they don't like, and they're afraid to look for another job because they have insurance.
Associated employer. Carried today all over the rest of the stations was how many people were spied on. It was a very good article I read by you.
Uh-huh.
How many people were spied on the Facebook. I carried that story today.
Uh-huh.
And with those numbers that have been exposed, I guess Facebook wanted to put the numbers out, I believe, didn't they?
Yes.
The article. Yeah.
Yeah, these companies are now saying we're getting so much heat from our customers because they think that everybody thinks they're being spied on that we want to be able to say, no, it's only 7,000 people here at Facebook or whatever the number was. I forget now.
That's correct. But, and then the one last story, I know we're going to be short on time. The last story is the debt ceiling. Republicans came out divided, and this should put an end to this whole debt ceiling controversy because they are not going to be able to attach anything to or stop the debt ceiling vote.
So America's economy is not going to crash, and we're not going to get our credit rating downgraded again.
They have no choice.
That is great. The Republicans have surrendered. Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, former member of the United States House of Representatives and the author of Sideswipe, a brilliant book. Bob, thanks so much for being with us. Always great talking. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard, count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIX, Wix.com. Everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. ITM Trading, America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com, you say it, they will build it. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These other writers support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. It is Wednesday, but Friday, Senator Sanders will not be available to be on our show, and so he has graciously offered to come on today, right now. So we're going to do our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting, where you can call in and ask a question of Senator Sanders, 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. You can call in and ask a question of Senator Sanders live and on the air. Senator Sanders, welcome.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Thank you for joining us and not missing a week. I really appreciate that. What's at the top of your mind right now?
There are a lot of things going on in D.C. Next week, I believe that I will have on the floor as chairman of the Veterans Committee the most comprehensive veterans legislation that we have seen in many decades. Among many other things, this will make it easier for vets to get into the VA healthcare system for the first time. We will begin providing dental care to a large number of veterans. I happen to believe that dental care is healthcare. VA currently does not do that unless it's service-connected, so we want to expand that. We're going to be dealing with the very serious problem of sexual assault. We'll be putting a greater emphasis on complementary and alternative medicine. A problem within the VA and outside of the VA is over-medication. And to the degree that concepts like acupuncture, meditation, yoga, nutrition can wean people away from too much medication, I think that's a good thing. And the VA is already doing a pretty good job in that. We want to expand that. So there are a lot of issues out there, and we're very proud that we have the support of the American Legion, the disabled American veterans, the veterans of foreign wars, the Vietnam vets, the Iraq and Afghanistan veterans of America, and virtually every veterans organization. So for those of us who understand that war plays it brings about a very heavy toll on people's life, I think this legislation is a major step forward, and we hope we can get it done.
Yeah, that's great.
So that's one issue that we're working on. The other issue is, I think, as people may have noticed, is the deficit is, in fact, going down. When Bush left office, the deficit was about $1.4 trillion. In 2013, it was $680 billion. In projection is that this year it'll be about $514 billion. So we've cut the deficit by more than half, which is not insignificant. It seems to me now that our focus has got to be on the economy and on creating jobs, because while the deficit has gone down, there is still no question that unemployment in this country is much, much too high. Real unemployment remains about 13%, youth unemployment about 20%, African-American youth unemployment 40%. So we have got to create millions of jobs, and God only knows there is enough work out there to do. I happen to believe very strongly that we should be investing in rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure, our roads, our bridges, wastewater plants, water systems, improving our rail system, improving our airports. And when you do that, you create jobs at all levels, from architects and PhD types to blue-collar construction workers. So there's a lot of work that we can create doing that. Furthermore, if we're serious about tackling and reversing climate change, there is a huge opportunity out there in terms of energy efficiency and weatherization and making our buildings far more energy efficient. I know that in Vermont, people who have their homes weatherized, and we're obviously a cold weather state, they sometimes can save 50% in their fuel bills. So we're saving consumers money. We are cutting greenhouse gas emissions, and we're creating local jobs. So investing in energy efficiency and the weatherization is something terribly important, and we can create jobs doing that. So I want to work on that issue. The other issue that is very much on my mind, and I think it's getting more and more attention, there was a good piece in the Washington Post today, is when we look at campaign finance and who is funding elections, it seems to me now we're looking at three major political institutions. You're looking at the Republican Party, you're looking at the Democratic Party, and now what you're looking at is, in a sense, the Koch brothers party. The Koch brothers, as I hope most people know, are one of the wealthiest families in America. They're worth somewhere around $77 billion, and they have pledged to contribute a very significant amount of money. We're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions, into the political process. And this disastrous Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, enables them to do that. So a very difficult question is, how do we deal with that? They are now flooding the airwaves in North Carolina and in other states, and they are prepared to spend unbelievable sums of money. And from their point of view, if you spend a few hundred million dollars or you spend $1 billion, that is a good investment if you can end up owning the United States government or state legislatures. So, you know, it is a good investment. The return on that investment will be very, very good. So how we deal with that, how we rally the American people to take on the Koch brothers and to take on this disastrous Citizens United decision, which is, in my view, undermining the very foundations of American democracy. You know, in Vermont, in March, we have town meetings where people decide on the school budget and how much they're going to spend on school plows and salaries for local officials and so forth. One person, one vote. That is, you know, what American democracy is supposed to be about. And now what you have is one family spending hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, and others also spending a huge sum of money. This is not what American democracy is supposed to be about. So I think we've got to work hard on rallying the American people. Not a lot of people are familiar with the issue. We have got to overturn Citizens United. I believe very strongly we've got to move to campaign public funding of elections. And the point here is, if you are concerned about health care, concerned about the economy, concerned about women's rights, you're concerned about climate change, you're concerned about education, no matter the issue that you are concerned about, how campaigns are funded and whether billionaire right-wing extremists can control the political process will impact every single issue out there. So we need to do a lot of work on this issue, or else you're going to see literally one family having more political impact in this country than either the Democratic or the Republican parties, and that is just unbelievable. So that's an issue we have to pay, I think, a great deal of attention to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, also coming before Congress, we're still working on some very important issues. I want to see an extension of long-term unemployment. Our Republican colleagues keep resisting. They keep telling us that they are sympathetic, but they want to make some devastating cuts to pay for it. That's wrong. We want to raise the minimum wage, and that bill should be on the floor within a few weeks. I know that 10-10 is, you know, not a particularly good wage, but it's an improvement over 7.25, which is what the national minimum wage is right now. So I want to raise that minimum wage and see about 30 million Americans get an increase in their wages. When we talk about the economy, we should never forget that one of the great problems we face is not just high unemployment, but that many of the new jobs being created are low-wage jobs and they're part-time jobs. And to me, it is totally absurd that we continue to provide, in a sense, public welfare for families like the Walton family that own Walmart, because they pay their workers such low wages that many of these workers have to turn to Medicaid or food stamps or publicly funded affordable housing. So raising the minimum wage is a step forward, but perhaps even more importantly, we have got to create millions of jobs to deal with the unemployment crisis that we face.
Right, and we can do that with infrastructure. And
there are more than enough ways that we can do that, have people do meaningful work, and put people back to work.
We'll pick it up on the other side. Yeah. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our brunch with Bernie a couple of days early here because Bernie is not going to be around on Friday. So and the board is full here. It's lighting up. It's almost full. So your calls for Senator Sanders in our national town hall meeting, brunch with Bernie, on Wednesday Yes, it's live. We're live. It's Wednesday. It's 4:15 Eastern Time. We'll be back with your calls before you go.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. Sign up for the Bernie Buzz. It's a great newsletter. And welcome back. Senator Sanders on the phone with us, and Daryl in Meadow Bridge, West Virginia, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Tom. It's a real pleasure to get to speak with you and Senator Sanders. I have a question about the Universal Service Telephone Fund that they recently converted into the Connect America Fund that's supposed to expand the Internet in rural areas. And my problem is my local telephone carrier is Frontier Communications, and when I discussed with them about possibly using some of those funds to give me some access to some kind of Internet here, because the only thing that I have is dial-up. I don't have any access to cell phone-type signals. I'm too far out of the way and so forth. And anyway, their excuse was that because they had a remote, all I'm trying to do is get DSL. And because they had a remote in my area, even though I was 25,000 feet out of range of it, they couldn't use any of these funds to help me. So I wonder if you guys had any.
Okay, Daryl, obviously I'm not familiar with your situation in West Virginia. What I can say is that we lag behind a number of other countries in terms of a broadband access and high-quality broadband. Our delegation, the Vermont delegation, worked very closely with the Department of Agriculture. We got a very significant grant, and we're quite a rural state. And I believe that, you know, within the next year or two, we're going to have reasonably fast broadband service in virtually every community in the state of Vermont. In some parts of the state, very, very fast broadband. This is a huge issue. It's a huge issue, obviously, in the modern era. It's very hard to survive without good quality broadband service. And it's important also for economic development, because I think what we're going to see is in our smaller towns, not only Vermont, but all over America, you can decide businesses, if they have access to high-quality broadband, if they have access to good cell phone service, they're going to come to small towns and start hiring some people. So it's a very important issue. I think Vermont is making some progress on it, and clearly I think the federal government has got to play a major role working with the private sector to make it happen. Every community in America should have high-quality broadband. It's the telephone service of the and the electric service of the 21st century. We need to make it happen.
And apropos of that, Bernie, in the 50 seconds we have before the break, New York Times yesterday had a brilliant story. It's one of the most forwarded stories from yesterday in the New York Times about how Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Saw it. Yep.
You saw it. Public utility. They're just dealing with it like it's water, and it's a gigabyte, a 1,000-megabyte service.
Right. We have that in part of Vermont as well. And the point about the article is Chattanooga is going to do very well economically because businesses are going to come there and take advantage of that fast Internet access service. And we need that all over the country.
Right. Meanwhile, by the way, just as an FYI, Kansas has some ALEC model legislation before their legislature to make it a crime for a city or municipality to own a broadband service or offer broadband. So, you know, the Koch brothers.
Why am I surprised?
Yeah, the Koch brothers funded ALEC is on the case. Senator Sanders with us, taking your calls in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie, right after this. 20 minutes past the hour. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour 2 days early here on the Tom Hartman Program. Senator Sanders taking your calls. Michael in Imperial Beach, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, Mr. Hartman. Hey, Senator Sanders. Senator Sanders, I believe it was Tom that told us Ireland is putting banksters on trial.
That was Iceland.
It was Iceland? Okay. Yeah. But even Ronald Reagan prosecuted the SNL
yep.
banksters.
Right.
Senator Sanders and Tom. If we don't indict anybody, has the statute of limitations run out for prosecution now that we're 6 to 7 years out? Have they got away with it?
Well, Michael, you've asked a good question and something that has troubled me from day one of the financial crisis. And here you have a situation where it is so crazy that you have J.P. Morgan Chase, which, if Tom, correct me if I'm wrong here, but my memory tells me that they paid something like $12 billion in fines.
Yeah, in that neighborhood, for criminal activity.
Right, and the punishment that their CEO, Jamie Dimon, got was a $20 million salary this year, which was a substantial increase over what he got last year. So I guess that the board of directors of J.P. Morgan Chase felt that the $12 billion or so that they paid out was a good deal for them, that he got a good deal. I think there is outrage all over this country with the understanding that you have greed and recklessness and illegal behavior on Wall Street having caused the terrible recession we remain in today, where millions of people have lost their jobs, they lost their homes, they lost their life savings. These guys are now paying out huge fines, and yet none of them are going to jail. And I think that kind of tells people in this country that we have a two-tier system of justice, and that if you're a working-class guy and you break a window or you're selling pot or something, that's one form of justice, to go to jail. But if you're a billionaire, you're representing some of the largest banks in the world, I guess you don't go to jail, despite the fact that your crime has impacted the lives of many millions of people. So Michael asked the right question, and we're doing our best on this. But Michael may remember, the situation is so pathetic, that a number of months ago the Department of Justice was saying, if we arrested some of these guys, it might literally have a negative impact on the whole financial system. So the phrase developed that they're not only too big to fail, they're too big to jail. But Michael is absolutely right. We need to bring criminal charges against criminals.
Ed, in Concord, California, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello. I'd like to talk to Bernie and you, Tom. I got a couple of questions. The thing you started about in Chattanooga, Tennessee, how did you go about it? I go to my city council meetings here in Concord, California, usually for stuff for the union to keep Walmart out of town, which we've done very successful here in Concord. I'd like to know, where would you go about? I'm not a very elegant person. I was just a construction worker. Didn't remember what to call it. So how would you go about getting something that started in your city? And my other thing is, I got this question about the fracking. Right away in my mind it came to me that these materials they put in the ground that are so toxic, and nobody knows where they come from, or you can't find out or whatever, and nobody knows what they are. I wonder if people or the companies are giving this stuff to them to put there instead of paying for it to be dumped, these hazards. Has anybody ever thought of that?
No, there's.
Am I just sick or something?
I don't think that is the case. But I think what people do perceive is, in terms of fracking, a lot of chemicals going deep into the ground, and they can in fact impact aquifers and pollute water. And there is a great concern about fracking in that regard, and I share that concern. And in terms of what your city can do, when I was mayor of the city of Burlington, we looked very hard at getting into the cable TV business because we looked around us and what we saw kind of were ripoffs, and we thought we could do better. We ended up not getting into it, but we got a hefty check from one of the companies when we decided not to do that. We were able to use that to help a lot of people. Burlington has also gone into broadband. And I'm not sure, but I suspect other communities have as well. So this is just the decision that your city council has to make. What they have to weigh is how much does it cost, how many people would want to take advantage of that, what kind of prices can they charge, can they be better than the other companies, and I think in many cases they can. So it's certainly something worth cities studying.
So the way that he should do that is just show up at the city council meeting and raise the topic.
People are unhappy with what they're getting now. If the quality is not good, if the prices are too high, a study should be done to see what the city can do.
Right. Leela in Solana Beach, California, listening at iHeartRadio. Leela, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi. Hi. Oh, great. I have a quick question. I may sound naive. I don't know, but we talk about money in politics and the Koch brothers and all these ginormous amounts of money corrupting our political system. Why are the politicians so corruptible? I don't understand. Do we elect crooks? I mean, why is it that money can influence them?
Well, I'll tell you why, Lila, and here's the situation. If you're in California, which is obviously the largest state in the country, where people have spent $50, $75, $80 million or more to run for statewide office, and how do you raise that money? Lila, if you want to run for governor or senator in California, how are you going to raise $80 million? And what ends up happening right now is because of our current disastrous campaign finance system, if somebody is very, very wealthy, and that's been the case in California, they can fund it themselves, and you're going to have to figure out how you raise an equivalent amount of money to deal with that. Or you're going to have to go to very, very wealthy people to raise the kind of funds you need to compete with somebody else. But what Citizens United has done is kind of taken the lid off of campaign funding. The sums are coming in, the costs are now astronomical, and people need to raise huge sums of money to compete. That's why we need public funding of elections.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us 2 days early for our Brunch with Bernie this week, taking your calls at our national town hall meeting here on the Tom Hartman program. Be sure and check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And, of course, you can drop by TomHartman.com, drop into our free live chat room and say hi. But we'll be back with more of your calls for Bernie right after this. 28 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. Our Brunch with Bernie hour a couple of days early, as Bernie will be unavailable on Friday. And, Senator, thank you for joining us here on Wednesday. You're there on the line?
I'm right here.
Okay, great. So we'll pick up some calls here. Dan in Harlinton, Montana. Hey, Dan, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hey. Senator Sanders, I just wanted to thank you for the work that you're doing with the veterans.
Thank you.
And also, is it possible to get rid of some of those Supreme Court judges or add some that aren't so corrupt?
Well, we certainly we certainly hope that in years to come we're going to have a Supreme Court that is not a right-wing Supreme Court and a Supreme Court that doesn't consistently rule for the wealthy and large corporations. The president makes the nominations, and right now the way the courts are, it's kind of 5-4 conservative Republican, and we hope that President Obama will be able in the remainder of his term to make additional appointments and give us a Supreme Court that lives in the real world, that interprets the Constitution for the American people, and not just for the large corporations and the wealthy. I think that the decision regarding Citizens United will go down in history as one of the very, very worst decisions ever made. It just indicates a Supreme Court that is, beholden actually to very wealthy and powerful people.
It's like Dred Scott, it's the mirror image. Dred Scott made people into property. Citizens United made property into people.
That's exactly right. It'll go down with Dred Scott as one of the worst decisions in history of the Supreme Court. But it's not only that. This is the Supreme Court that, many of these judges were appointed by Republicans, and they have turned out to be, extremely right-wing.
Yep. Stephen, in Deming, Washington, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, gentlemen. Thanks for having me. Wanted to get your response to something that's bothered me for a long time. There's a misspeak, a doublespeak, that's just huge in regard to the word free, which, mm-hmm. of course, we're a free country, and everybody just, you brighten right up at the word free. Well, we have a big push for free markets and for free trade. And the fact is that I think you'll agree that free trade is so blessedly, exorbitantly expensive, it could actually put our economy on and that free markets have been responsible for the economic implosion that we went through in 2008 and are still dealing with.
So your question, Steve?
Calling that for what it is and say free trade is not free.
Well, you're absolutely right on that. You know, this whole issue, and I think Stephen makes a very, very good point on what freedom is about. Our right-wing Republican colleagues believe that what freedom is about is allowing wealthy and powerful people to exploit working families and the middle class, that that's somehow freedom. Let me give you an example of that. You have many Republicans, and people don't know this, who not only are opposed to raising the minimum wage from above $7.25 an hour, where it currently is, they believe that we should abolish the concept of the minimum wage. Because to them, picking up on Stephen's point, what freedom is about is not having the government regulating a minimum wage, but allowing people to work for $3 an hour or for $4 an hour and allowing a free relationship to exist between an employer and a worker without the government getting involved. And what freedom is about in terms of the environment, if you are a company and you're dumping crap into the air and into the water, which will make people sick or kill people, that's freedom. And we don't want the government stopping you from having the freedom to do that kind of pollution. So I think, you know, Stephen is right. We really need to have a strong discussion about what freedom is. And I happen to believe that if people are desperately, desperately trying to survive economically and desperately trying to figure out how they can put gas in their car to get to work or how they can feed their kids, that doesn't sound like freedom to me. It doesn't sound like freedom to me. So I think when we talk about freedom, it's not just the right to vote every 2 years or every 4 years. It also means economic security. Security, so you can enjoy life. So you have the freedom to take a vacation. You have the freedom to move from one job to another. So it is, Steve's right. I think this is an issue that needs a lot of discussion.
Paul, listening to WCPT in Northbrook, Illinois. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi. Senator Sanders?
Yep.
Yes, hi. It's an honor to speak with you. Thank you for doing this and taking these calls. I had a question on the legislator and the legislating abortion. This has always been a problem of mine. Not everybody in this country is a Christian. So I respect the legislators that truly believe in abortion, but that's their religion and that's their belief. Why would they legislate that for others? In my view, as a Jew, if I was a senator, even though ham is very offensive to me, I would not try to outlaw it for the rest of the Americans because I respect the fact that there's other religions. I respect that people don't like abortion. I don't like abortion, but why would they legislate their religion for me?
Well, that's a good question, and I share your perspective here. And, you know, and interestingly enough, Tom, it gets back to the question that Stephen just asked about the word freedom. I find it hard to understand how my conservative colleagues who tell us how much they believe in human freedom and how much they believe in choice and how much they believe in small government and how much they believe in getting the government out of our lives suddenly believe that they have the right to tell every woman in America what she can do with her body. It doesn't sound like small government to me. It sounds like a very intrusive government. Doesn't sound like supporting freedom for women to make that choice. So I think there is an absolute contradiction between those people saying, hey, we believe in freedom, get the government out of your life. But by the way, we have a perspective on abortion, and every woman in America has to share that view. So I think there is an absolute contradiction. And I think, by the way, most Americans see it that way as well.
Tim, in Somerdale, Ohio, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, how you doing today, guys?
Good.
Good.
I was listening to your conversation before about this broadband and how Tennessee did.
Mm-hmm.
Or so yesterday. You know, what is rural people going to do, though? You know, it seems like we're always the ones that miss out on everything. The high-speed internet comes across, a power company comes across, but because you're out there and there's not enough revenue around you, you know, we get bypassed.
No, you're right. And, you know, the answer is, as you've just indicated, if you're in an urban area where you can get a whole lot of customers, it's a more profitable situation than doing broadband in a rural area where you may have a few customers every mile. I mean, that's the problem we face in the state of Vermont, which is one of the most rural states in the country. We ended up getting a significant federal grant. I would have structured the grant, frankly, differently than it was, in fact, structured. But we are in the process right now, and I think within a couple of years, where every rural community in Vermont will have access to high-quality wireless broadband, and a couple of our towns will have very high-quality fiber optic and some of the fastest broadband in the country. But I think the point here is that the government has got to be involved in helping rural areas, because, as Kim indicates, it's just an expensive proposition for companies to do it in an area where there's not going to be a whole lot of revenue. But we cannot abandon rural America, and they need the same opportunity. Their kids need the same opportunity. Their businesses need the same opportunity as urban America in terms of high quality. And
So it's time for the broadband equivalent of the REA.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
That's what we're talking about.
Charles in Mandeville, Louisiana, watching us on YouTube. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. Senator Sanders, I just want to thank you for your persistence of sanity in the job that you hold. And if I lived in your state, I'd be incredibly proud. My question for you is, do you realistically in your heart of hearts think it will ever be possible for us to see campaign finance reform, big money from corporations from flowing into elections, and possibly term limits for the government?
1 minute to the break, Bernie.
The short answer is yes, I really do. But what we have got to do, Charles, is make campaign finance as important an issue as jobs in the economy, as education, as health care, as climate change. Because all of those issues and everything else is dependent upon who gets elected, and who gets elected is absolutely dependent upon this disastrous campaign finance situation we have right now. So you're asking me, do I think we can pull this off? I do. But we're going to need to rally the American people to understand the importance of campaign finance reform. I'm not sure that we are there yet, but we are making some progress, and I do believe that we can do this.
Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls in our national town hall meeting here on Wednesday. Yes, we're live, and it's Wednesday. It's 4:45 here on the East Coast. Here, Brunch with Bernie. A couple of days early because Bernie won't be with us on Friday. We'll be right back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders. Right.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And be sure to check out Bernie's website at Sanders.Senate.gov. It's a great news site. Plus, you can sign up for his newsletter, The Bernie Buzz. Welcome back. Barry in Slatington, Pennsylvania, watching on Free Speech TV on the Direct TV satellite. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. You're one of my heroes, by the way.
Thank you very much.
I was just wondering, is there a way for you to get the real information out about the excess speculation on oil by Wall Street? I look at that as one of the main problems with the economy right now, especially in the north in this winter because we're spending $1,000 to fill our heating oil tanks. But I found a lot of people don't know the truth about this, and I know you did some research on this.
Yeah, we did. Well, what we did, some of the folks on Wall Street were not terribly happy, but a couple of years ago, we got access to some information which we made public. And I think the issue that Barry is talking about is trying to figure out why oil prices, or in fact, prices at the gas pump, are as high as they are, and there are a number of reasons. I mean, for a start, clearly we have companies like ExxonMobil and other huge oil companies that, through their concentration of ownership and their power, are able to rip off the American people. And these guys often make huge profits, and in a given year, companies like a company like ExxonMobil may pay nothing in federal income taxes. They are just enormously powerful in terms of the amount of money they make, their ability of their lobbyists to influence tax legislation and other legislation, et cetera, et cetera. That's clearly one of the reasons. But what Barry is talking about, and what is not widely known, is that speculation on the part of companies like Morgan Stanley and other Wall Street financial institutions also play a very significant role in driving up the price of oil. Year after year, we have seen recently that in terms of supply and demand, supply is high and demand goes down, and yet oil prices go up. The theory is that when you have more supply and less demand, prices should go down, but we see prices go up. And one of the reasons is that a lot of the oil futures market, the energy futures market, is controlled not by people who actually use oil or gas, like the airlines or trucking companies. It is controlled by Wall Street speculation. And there are varying estimates as to how much that speculation is costing us for a gallon of gas or a gallon of home heating oil, but it is very, very significant. We have been working on this issue. It is a, like every other issue, when you're taking on Wall Street or the oil companies, in this case, Wall Street, it is a tough issue to accomplish what you want. But Charles makes Barry makes a very important point, and it's an issue we've got to stay on.
Senator, wouldn't it be a fairly straightforward way to do it? We have about 30 seconds here. To simply say that when trading commodities, the traders have to actually be genuine counterparties. They have to actually be willing to take delivery or make delivery?
Right. That is one way to do it. The other way to do it is to say that no individual entity could own more than a certain percentage of the commodity. And we're looking at both of those. And you know, I think we've had a little bit of success on this. We've exposed some of what goes on. But I believe that on a given day, a couple of years ago, I think it was over 70% of the oil in the energy futures market was controlled by Wall Street.
By bankers who are not going to take the oil.
Right. No, they're just there to make money.
They're just hustling. Amazing. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Check out his website, sanders.senate.gov. You can sign up for the Bernie Buzz. We'll be back with more of your questions for Senator Sanders right after this. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Austin in Mount Carmel, Tennessee, watching Free Speech TV on the direct satellite system. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Tom, thank you, and help me. I have to make this in the form of a question. I have a business arrangement with Free Speech Television. I give them $30 a month. They give me brunch with Bernie. Now, I want to give $30 a month to Senator Sanders, if he will run for president. Put that in the form of a question for me, Tom, because it has to be that way.
Okay. Bernie, I'll just toss it to Bernie.
Awesome. Thanks very, very much. What I have said over the last few months, because that question has come up pretty often, is I do not wake up in the morning with a desire to be president of the United States. I really don't. I'm extraordinarily proud to represent the state of Vermont. And given my political views, it's quite extraordinary that I am in the United States Senate. That doesn't happen every day. And I am the longest serving independent in the history of the United States in Congress. But what I have said is that there are so many important issues, vitally important issues, life and death issues facing working families and the middle class that have got to be addressed. We cannot continue to allow the middle class to disappear. We cannot continue to have the highest rate of childhood poverty in the industrialized world. We cannot continue to have the most unequal distribution of wealth and income of any major country on earth. We cannot continue to have 13% real unemployment. These issues have got to be discussed. We need candidates who are going to be out there not representing corporate interests or Wall Street, but representing working families. And if there are not other candidates who are prepared to jump in to fight for the working class of this country, I would be prepared to do that. But again, it's not something that I am, you know, staying up nights desiring to do, but it has to be done. Somebody has to do it. There are other people out there, but if other people do not come forward, I am prepared to do that.
That's great. Charlene, in Nokomis, Illinois, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Well, so I was wondering why the Democratic leaders didn't join in and support the Occupy Wall Street protesters when they know that protesting is the only way we're going to break the stranglehold that the elite rich have on our nation.
Charlene, that's a good question. And the answer is that, unfortunately, you have too many Democrats who are tied to corporate interests, who are not prepared to forcefully deal with the issues that Occupy Wall Street raise. And the two main issues that they raised were income and wealth inequality. I'm happy to say that I think people are now beginning to raise that. The president is talking about it. Others are talking about it. Are they talking about it as forcefully as they should? Are they coming up with the kinds of legislation that we need? Well, we're making some modest progress, but not enough. And the other issue, of course, that Occupy Wall Street talked about was Wall Street. And that is, wow, that is an issue that a lot of people are just basically afraid to talk about because of the power of Wall Street. And I would just point out to listeners that we obviously bailed out Wall Street when it collapsed because they were too big to fail. And the feeling was if they went out, I voted against that, but Congress voted to bail them out because the feeling is the whole economy would disintegrate if we didn't prop them up. Virtually every one of those top six banks that were bailed out is now significantly larger than it was before we bailed them out. And this is an issue of such magnitude. Tom, just think about if Teddy Roosevelt, you know, the guy who was busy, you know, back 100 years ago breaking up Standard Oil or the railroad trusts, if he were alive today, as a Republican for that matter, looking at a situation where six financial institutions have assets equivalent to two-thirds of the GDP of the United States of America, where they wrote half of the mortgages in this country and two-thirds of the credit cards in this country. Don't you think people would be talking about breaking up these huge financial
institutions? Teddy's rolling over in his grave. I mean, Richard Nixon initiated breaking up AT&T. Jimmy Carter finished it.
Well, it just speaks to the fact, getting back to money and politics, these, and everybody's got to know it. I'm not happy to tell you this, but it is the simple truth. They are enormously powerful. Earlier in the show, somebody said, how come none of these guys are going to jail? They are very powerful. How come we're not breaking them up? How come people are not talking about the insidious role that Wall Street plays in American society? I just read something. It's an incredible fact. Just read it the other day. That in 2012, the top 40 hedge fund managers in this country made over $16 billion. Okay? The top 40 hedge fund managers made up $16 billion. That is equivalent, Tom, to what 300,000 public school teachers make.
Wow.
Got that?
Wow.
40 guys on Wall Street making the equivalent of what 300,000 public school teachers in this country are making. Does that make sense to anybody?
No.
And that's where we are. But, you know, these guys, especially with Citizens United, you stand up to them, they're prepared to... You know, they're prepared to destroy you, and they're prepared to spend enormous amounts of money against you.
Right.
So that's I know people are not comfortable hearing that, and you know, I'm not happy to have to say that, but that is the simple reality.
We have just 1 minute left, although we have callers from Oregon, South Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, Montana, and Illinois on the line. Your thoughts for all of them?
Well, you know, we always get back to the same point. The only way you beat the Koch brothers and Wall Street and all of the big money interests who have so much power in Washington is through education and organization. And the American people have got to be talking to each other. We've got to be standing together. We've got to be well organized. And at the end of the day, and I often make this point, while Congress is very divided, the truth is that on many major issues, there is a lot more commonality of interest among the American people. And poll after poll tells us the American people do not want to cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. The American people want a major jobs program to provide millions of jobs for unemployed workers. The American people do want the wealthiest people in this country and the largest corporations to stop paying their fair share of taxes. That's what the American people want. That is not what Congress is doing. Our job is to rally the American people and make that happen.
Senator, thanks so much for being with us this week.
My pleasure.
Always a pleasure and honor to host you here. Senator Bernie Sanders, be sure and check out his website, sanders.senate.gov. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard, count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIX, Wix.com, everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. ITM Trading, America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com, you say it, they will build it. Granger, for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
Listening to the Tom Hartman program.
6 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you to the third hour of our program. And, okay, somebody corrected me. I went off on a rant earlier about Steve Jobs. It wasn't so much a rant. It was just a response to this guy who was saying, hey, you know, we need the 1%. They're the job creators and all that. And I'm like, eh. He said Steve Jobs started with nothing. Apparently, Steve Jobs, I haven't read the biography, so I shouldn't have said anything before I did. My correspondent here says Steve Jobs was raised in a lower middle class environment. He went to Reed College. His parents had to borrow from their life savings to send him. Big part of his success was because he forced his parents to move. That's an interesting thing for a kid to do. With Steve becoming friends with a neighbor who eventually introduced him to Steve Wozniak. Bill Gates, on the other hand, did come from money, and his family's wealth undoubtedly contributed, but et cetera, et cetera. I would add, though, that, you know, I'd go back to my original point. If he had been born poor and a minority, it might have been a very different story. The point is that none of us gets here just on our own. That was the point that I was trying to make. And many of these giant monopolies, whether it's Microsoft or Apple or you know, J.P. Morgan Chase or General Motors, or I mean, you fill in the blanks. Any of these giant companies that tend to dominate industries, that they're getting there by virtue of the fact that we are providing them with the infrastructure necessary. We the taxpayers. By providing them with a court system where they can enforce contracts, the vast majority of our court system is used by business. It's not the criminal, you know, we all watch the, you know, you watch the cop shows, you see the criminal justice system. That's a small part of the cost of the court system. Most of the court system is used by corporations. Who pays for it? You and I do. It's paid for with taxes. And for example, I mean, just as one example, I mean, our businesses in America use an educated workforce, and it's educated at our expense. Our businesses in America use public utilities that are paid for, you know, at least the siting of them is paid for by us. And that's not a bad thing. It's just an acknowledgement that nobody got there on their own. This idea that somebody is entitled to take $1 billion in income, that somehow anybody their work could be so valuable that it's worth taking $1 billion a year in income. Like, you know, some of these guys on Wall Street do. I would say to you, it's a scam. I mean, there are brain surgeons and heart surgeons and rocket scientists and high-level engineers and people who are just doing really, really difficult, really, really brilliant work, who spent their lives getting to the point where they could do that work, and they're making $200, $300, $400, $500, $600,000 a year, maybe $1 million a year. And they're taking it as ordinary income, and they're paying a maximum 39% because they're taking a paycheck on it. But the Mitt Romneys of the world, the guys who have figured out how to game the system and make $20, $30, $40 million a year, $100 million a year, $200 million a year, the Stephen J. Hemsleys of the world with his $1 billion of income from United Healthcare, or Dollar Bill McGuire, who preceded him with $1.6 billion in income for running a health insurance company? Really? And so much of it coming in the form of stock options that you, when you convert them, you pay a maximum of, you know, 5 to 20% income tax on, whereas that brain surgeon is paying 39%. These people aren't noble capitalists, brought themselves up by the bootstrap folks. They're people who figured out how to game the system. And in many cases, it's not just that they figured out how to game the system. Because the Supreme Court, this constitutional monarchy that we have here in the United States, the Supreme Court has laid out a brand new set of rules for doing business in the United States and doing politics in the United States when they discovered back in 1971 in the Buckley versus Vallejo decision. They discovered that money is protected by the First Amendment. Now, I have the Constitution right here in front of me. And the First Amendment is one sentence long. It says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. Did you hear the word money in there? Listen really carefully, because the Supreme Court 38 years ago last week said money is protected by the First Amendment. Congress shall make no laws respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances, period. I don't see money in there anywhere, but five right-wingers on the Supreme Court do. And ever since 1803 in the Marbury case, although it only happened twice in the first half of the 19th, it didn't happen at all in the late 18th century, only happened twice in the first half of the 19th century. Marbury v. Madison, 1803. Dred Scott, 1856. Only twice did the Supreme Court say that they had the power to strike down a law passed by Congress. Judicial supremacy. We are more powerful than the legislature. We are more powerful than the President of the United States. The first 70 years of our republic, it only happened twice. Now, virtually every single case the Supreme Court takes, they are asserting in those cases that they have the power to strike down the law or, as in this case, finding the word money in the First Amendment when it's not there, to create law. They did the same thing in Roe v. Wade when they came up with the idea that there's three different trimesters and each trimester should have different rules. There's nothing in the Constitution that says that the Supreme Court can make law. That's the job of the legislature. So anyhow, they said that money is protected by the First Amendment. And then they said in the 14th Amendment that corporations are protected by the 14th Amendment. Now, here's Section 1 of the 14th Amendment. This is the part in which they found this. This was ratified in 1868, July 9th, 1868, in order to help free the slaves, right? The 13th Amendment bans slavery. The 14th Amendment establishes civil rights for former slaves. And the 15th Amendment gives the absolute right to vote to African Americans. Okay, these three amendments passed after the Civil War. And tell me if you hear the word corporation in here somehow, because the Supreme Court also, this is 2 years after Buckley, in a case called First National Bank versus Bilotti, decided that corporations are persons. Now, there's other cases, too, where they had, you know, implied or suggested that. But not just persons, not just actors who have to pay taxes. I mean, we all agree that, you know, they have some sort of status. They pay taxes, they can own land, things like that, sign contracts. But that they were persons protected by the Constitution. That's a whole different ball of wax. the 14th Amendment, Section 1, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof, which would include slaves or former slaves, are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. And that very last phrase of that section, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws, that is what the Supreme Court said applies to corporations. Now, I didn't know that Abe Lincoln fought the Civil War to free the corporations. But our Supreme Court tells us this. And the net of all that is that, you know, taking this back to Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, is that because of these two decisions, these giant corporations have been able to buy politicians.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And they continue to not only buy politicians, but intimidate politicians, and thus get laws passed that make the rich richer. And, of course, everybody else poor. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Mr. Kim in New Rochelle, New York, listening on WBAI. How are you today, sir?
I'm alive and well, thank you very much. Under a lot of snow in New York, but so is everybody else.
Yeah, it's rain here in D.C., but we had our snow. So what's up?
Yes. Okay, well, the topic I wanted to broach here, every time we hear Republicans, they say you can't raise the minimum wage because it's going to increase unemployment.
Right.
And people won't hire, and everything will go right down the tubes and into perdition.
Right, which has never happened in the history of America.
And not only has it never happened, the opposite is the case.
Yes.
And if we look in the Great Depression, when they invented the minimum wage,
right.
they instituted it, and wages went up, unemployment went down.
Yep.
And it was fairly consistent through most of the recovery under Roosevelt.
Yep.
In the 60s, I remember working for $1.25 an hour. By the end of the 60s, it was up to $3.90, I believe it was, four raises by Democrats, and unemployment fell from about 8% down to, 68 was 3.5%. So exactly the opposite took place, and the same thing under Clinton took place as well.
Yep.
So here we are with the opposite of the real world, and the Republicans keep repeating this thing. I think we ought to expose their fairy tales.
Well, I'm doing my best. I mean, I do it on the radio every day. I do it on TV at night. I'm writing pieces, articles about this. I've written several books on it. I'm doing my best, and I know you are too. And I think all of us, you know, all of the you know, three or more million people who are listening to this program need to be telling everybody they know that when the history shows that when the minimum wage goes up, unemployment goes down. The number of jobs created is increased. And there's a very logical, very mathematical, very practical reason for that. And that is that minimum wage workers spend 100% of everything they get. Mitt Romney doesn't. If Mitt Romney's wages go up from $20 million a year to $25 million a year, he just puts another $5 million in a Swiss bank account. It has no effect on our economy. If somebody working at McDonald's salary goes up by $1 an hour and they get an extra $1,000 a year or whatever it is, they spend 100% of that, and that's an injection, a direct injection of that $1,000 into the economy, which creates demand. They're going to stores and buying things. Those stores then need to buy more of those things. They need to buy them from the wholesalers and the manufacturers. The manufacturers need to hire more people to make them, and when they hire more people to make them, then those people now have jobs, and they go out and buy things, and you have this virtuous cycle as a consequence of this. And that's why, for the last 6 years, Republicans have been doing everything they can to block minimum wage increases or any kind of anything that's going to inject money at the bottom of the economy, because they want the Obama presidency to be known as a failed presidency, and they are hoping desperately that they can take the Senate and the White House in 2014 and 2016 by this economic sabotage. And they're doing Goebbels' big lie. You know, if you tell a lie that's big enough and audacious enough and you repeat it often enough, people will begin to believe it. And that's what's going on. And Mr. Kim, you have absolutely nailed it. It is so true what you are saying. Thank you very much for the call. Thanks for listening to WBAI. And we will be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. 866-987-THOM is our telephone number. Stick with me. Maybe you shouldn't drop by the chat room. There's somebody in there saying I'm really hot. Uh-oh. No, what can I say? Thank you. 20 minutes past the hour. Shane and Danielle are both falling on the floor with that one. Wade in Graniteville, South Carolina. Hey, Wade, what's on your mind today?
Good afternoon, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. In regards to Citizens United and the Koch brothers spending, I agree with repealing Citizens United, but I got a question, seeing that that takes so long.
Oh, it doesn't have to take so long.
Opportunity where we can convince the people to not listen to these ads, because speech is only speech if we listen to it.
Well, you make a good point, Wade, and that's actually the argument that the conservative justices in Citizens United made, was that, you know, corporations have the right to speak, but people don't have the obligation to listen. And, you know, I think it's tough to, in the real world, in the practical world. I mean, if you're watching a TV show that you really like and a commercial comes on and it's well done, it grabs your attention. And if advertising didn't work, it wouldn't be a multi-billion dollar, maybe a trillion dollar industry. And if political advertising didn't work, you wouldn't see, you know, the last election costing over $1 billion. I think, but here's the, you know, that seems like kind of the bad news. Here's the good news. You know, maybe, are you old enough to remember when they lowered the voting age?
Yes.
Back in 71, it was the 26th Amendment. The 26th Amendment, now in 1971, we were at war in Vietnam. Richard Nixon was president. Barry Maguire, a little before or after, I mean, you know, sometime around that time, I'm going to have to look it up one of these days, because I always thought that Barry Maguire's Eve of Destruction song had something to do with this. You know, where he said, you're old enough to kill, but not for voting. The 26th Amendment was proposed in Congress on March 23rd, 1971. Okay, March 23rd. It had to go through two-thirds of the House and Senate, as I recall, and then it had to go through three-quarters of the states. That's a pretty high bar. I mean, you know, there's been over 29,000 amendments proposed to the Constitution, and there's only, you know, 27 of them that ever made it. Okay, the 28th one that we're trying to get through is to say money is not speech, it's property, and that corporations aren't people, they're voluntary associations. But in the 26th Amendment was proposed on March 23rd. It was ratified on July 1st of the same year. So you've got last week of March, all of April, all of May, all of June. So it took 3 months and a week from the time this thing dropped on the floor of the House and Senate to the time three-quarters of the states said, yes, we agree. It took 3 months and a week to pass that amendment, giving 18-year-olds the right to vote. And the reason why is because there was a consensus across the United States that it was the right thing to do. If we're going to send these young people in the draft off to Vietnam to die, they should have the right to vote for their representatives who are you know, promoting the war, or for representatives who want to stop the war. And I believe that when enough people realize that the only way to stop the Supreme Court, the only way to get around the Supreme Court right now, given, you know, the history of the Supreme Court and the history of America, is to pass a constitutional amendment. Congress can't do it. Congress could do it, arguably, but they can't and they won't. The only way to do this is by a constitutional amendment. And there's a backdoor way to do it. It's called an Article 5 Constitutional Convention, which is you introduce this constitutional amendment in the identical language and get it passed by three-quarters of the states. And when that happens, then the House and Senate are required to take it up. They have no choice in the matter. John Boehner has to bring it to the floor for a vote, and Harry Reid has to bring it to the floor of the Senate for a vote. It has to happen. And at that point, there's little doubt in my mind that it would pass in both the House and the Senate, because these guys would love to be free of the influence of money, Republicans and Democrats alike. I mean, there's a few, you know, Darrell Issa has, I think, $700 million. He's the richest guy in the House of Representatives. He can kind of basically buy his own election, so he probably wouldn't vote for it. But most of them hate the fact, Republicans and Democrats, and independents too, that they have to spend hours dialing for dollars. They hate this. And so I think that this would happen, and it would happen fast. And when you've got over 500 communities that have passed resolutions in favor of this, you've got 22 states now that have passed resolutions, non-binding resolutions in favor of this, movetoamend.org, the Move to Amend Coalition, is really making this thing happen. And everybody needs to get over to movetoamend.org, sign up, create a local chapter, wake people up. When we hit that critical threshold, and frankly, I think that when about 20% of the this is what history shows us, is that when about 20% of the population really gets something and feels passionate about it, that's when society changes. Thorsten Veblen had this whole theory about, you know, influencing the influencers, that 20% then influences everybody else and it becomes conventional wisdom. And I think right now it's maybe 5% or 10%. And so if all of us, you know, who are part of that 5 or 10% who realize that we have to pass a constitutional amendment to overturn not just Citizens United, but all the things that preceded it as well, to say that money emphatically is not protected by the First Amendment and that corporations are not protected by the 14th Amendment, period, full stop. Pass a very simple constitutional amendment to say that, and the language is over at movetoamend.org. If every single person who knows that and believes that could just convince three people, we would have it. And like I said, you know, the 26th Amendment was passed in 3 months and 1 week. It can happen that fast, Wade. So can you get out there and tell some friends?
Tom, I agree, and I've been working with that. And I'm just asking, is there a short-term opportunity that we can do something different?
I think trying to ignore political ads isn't going to work, although we can decry them. We can talk, you know, we can trash talk them. We can try to tell the truth and speak back to money, but we ultimately have to get money out of politics. Wade, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
As long as our politics are controlled by money, we don't have a democratic republic. We have an oligarchy. And that's not a good thing. The bad and the very, very ignominiously ugly. The good. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. On Tuesday, the New York lawmaker announced that she would introduce her newest piece of legislation, the Family and Medical Insurance Leave Act, or Family Act. If passed, the family would provide a universal nationwide system of paid family and medical leave. The idea is to make sure that everyone, no matter how much they make or where they work, can take off time to care for a sick family member. Congress should follow Senator Gillibrand's lead and pass the Family Act as soon as possible and put the United States in line with the rest of the developed world when it comes to family leave policy. After all, even Afghanistan has a paid leave system. The bad. Laura Ingraham. During a broadcast of her radio show yesterday, the conservative pundit and Fox News contributor criticized Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor for saying that the term illegal alien was offensive. Take a listen.
Justice Sotomayor, according to the Drudge Report, Justice Sotomayor is saying labeling illegals as criminals is insulting.
That is a Supreme Court justice, an associate justice of the Supreme Court, who swore to uphold the federal laws and the U.S. Constitution. Her duty is to defend the Constitution. Why do we have a Supreme Court justice whose allegiance obviously goes to, you know, her immigrant family background, not to the U.S. Constitution?
Laura is entitled to whatever opinion she wants, no matter how offensive her opinions are, but she's not entitled to her own facts. Sonia Sotomayor is not an immigrant. She's a U.S. citizen whose family is from Puerto Rico. But even if she were an immigrant, why would that really matter? And the very, very ugly, the U.S. Border Patrol. A San Diego chapter of the organization is under fire today over photos surfaced of its agents showing little children how to shoot at human-like targets at a charity event last June. Here's a clip from a local news story on the controversy.
Border Patrol agents supervise as young children hold paintball guns and shoot human-like targets along the San Ysidro-Tijuana border fence, an activity immigrant rights activist Pedro Rios calls disturbing.
It resembles, it symbolizes
who the targets are for Border Patrol.
Migrants similar to these, says Rios. The photos were taken last June at the annual San Diego Fallen Agents Memorial 5K run. A spokesman with the Border Patrol tells Embassy 7 that it was a family-friendly event where off-duty agents held a variety of demonstrations.
Right. Teaching kids to shoot at human targets that look like undocumented immigrants. Sounds real family-friendly, guys. Just very, very ugly. That's incredibly ugly. Remarkable. Remarkable. Well, you know, what can you say? It's just incredible. Anyhow, well, back to your calls here and the issues of the day. Well, this is interesting. Greg in Chicago. Greg, you want to oppose the minimum wage because you own a small business?
I didn't say oppose. The question I have is that I find it appalling that a third party who has no clue what my margins are or how the business is structured for profit or loss to tell me what I should pay somebody, because if you do raise it, factually you've just increased the product itself and passing those costs on to the consumers, which right. then turn cost the employees more money. So,
okay. Well, let's then get government out of your business altogether. Let's say that anytime you want to enforce a contract, you're going to have to pay the thousands of dollars that it costs to run our court system. Anytime that you want to hire somebody who knows how to read and write, you're going to have to reimburse the government, you know, $10,000-$20,000 for their public education. That anytime, let's do away with your limits of liability so that if one of your employees does something bad or anything happens in your corporation that's bad, you can be personally prosecuted rather than it has to go through the corporation. And let's do away with the limitations of liability on investments so that if anything goes wrong, I mean, right now under current corporate law, the most you can lose is whatever you've invested in your company. Let's make it so that you can lose absolutely everything. Let's just make this, let's do away with all the benefits that you get as a business owner so that you as a business owner don't have to give a little bit of a benefit to one of your workers.
So you're going to go about changing all these laws and impose that how every time you make these strong...
No, I'm trying to make the point, Greg, that doing business in this country is a privilege, not a right. It's a privilege that comes with a certain price. And that price is that you conduct your business in a way that, at the very least, is not harmful to your community. And I would submit to you that if you are paying people a wage that is so low that I have to pay for their food stamps, and I have to pay for their housing, and I have to pay for their Medicare, then you're running a business along a business model that is basically parasitic.
So the mindset that the tariffs and stuff that our government chooses not to enforce, that you've got to compete with a third world country, I mean, we can go on for this forever, but the point that I made was...
I'm with you on that.
Honestly, how that's going to happen, because this is ridiculous, and the whole point that a third party, again, because if you guys want to go after...
Third party
Costco,
is the government.
I'm all for this. If you want to go after Costco, Walmart, all those guys, Costco isn't attacked because they're union and they pay higher wages. I understand that.
Right.
But if you want to go after McDonald's and all these guys, then write the law to go after them, because you are going to hurt a ton of people with collateral damage with that mindset and that type of theory of thinking when it comes to economics.
Greg, history does not demonstrate that. History demonstrates that every time the minimum wage goes up, that if you have a small business, what kind of business do you have?
That's not relevant, because it's not. Because my point is, if minimum wage is such a critical
So you don't have a small business, because I think most people who actually own small businesses understand this.
Okay. Again, then why wouldn't you set minimum wage for $30 an hour?
Because that would be stupid.
Why? Why is there a limit to the point of it?
You set the minimum wage at the minimum level of money that is necessary to have a relatively decent stress-free life in America. And by stress-free, I'm not talking about sitting around, you know, eating peeled grapes. You know what I'm talking about. You can't.
No, I don't, because I don't know how you can think like that. You can't. So what is a happy medium? We already have poverty lines and all this.
1968, the minimum wage was $10.10. It was $10.17 an hour. It worked just fine.
A loaf of bread was 8 cents.
Pardon?
It's not comparative. Comparative wage, comparative cost, if they kept up with each other, Tom, I agree with you. It would be somewhere around the $22 to $23 an hour mark. I absolutely agree with that. But the reality is it goes back to, again, cause and effect. Because our government chooses not to enforce certain tariffs and other restrictions that we have because we want to be nice and be global,
there are ramifications.
No, it's not got nothing to do with being nice and being global. It has to do with transnational corporations buying off our politicians, which takes us back to my Supreme Court rant. But
that's my point there. You want to take money out of politics, and again, let's use the Koch brothers as boogeymen. That's fine, but how much money did Obama spend to get reelected?
My point. It shouldn't have to be. It shouldn't be. But that has nothing to do with the minimum wage either. Are you changing the subject because you want to, you know?
No, minimum wage should be set by supply and demand. That's always worked to an extent.
No, it's never worked. No, Greg, when minimum wage is set by supply and demand, what you get is the world that Charles Dickens wrote about. You get a very, very large working poor class, literally more than 90% of all people living right on, you know, hanging on by their fingernails. You get and all the things that go along with that, crime and sexually transmitted diseases and child prostitution and everything else. That's what you get that. And then you get a very small middle class, which is people like you and me who own businesses, and then you and the professional class, and you get a very small ruling elite. And that's it.
I agree with the ruling elite, but without us poor that can't purchase it, what could you possibly sell somebody if you're encouraging people to be homeless?
I think you're making my argument. When you increase the minimum wage, what you do is you inject money into the bottom of the system. Those people have more money to spend. They spend it. And when they spend it, they stimulate the economy. More people show up in your business and buy more of your products.
If you give somebody a quarter and something costs a quarter more, all you're doing is moving money around. That's all you're doing.
No,
you call
that's
that,
not, that is, the, you know, the, this is simple macroeconomics. The economies are rarely static. In a feudal society, yes, an economy is static unless you get the Black Plague. But basically you had, you know, 800 years of static, stable economies in Europe with the exception of the 1300s when the plague hit. But typically economies, you know, in democracies, economies are not static. Economies, you know, and capitalism has ups and downs and all this sort of stuff. And the economy is not static. And so the question is, actually, I'm going off on a tangent. The question is, if somebody is going to do business in America, what are the rules to do business? Just like if somebody's going to play football, what are the rules for football, right? And so,
locally, you have those.
Is it fair in football that you can put your elbow into somebody's kidney? No. So is it fair in business that you can pay somebody so little money that in order for them to, even if they're working a 40-hour or 50-hour week, in order for them to survive, they have to go to the taxpayers to get food and shelter? That makes no sense. That's a predatory, parasitic business model.
Our educational system in this country has failed dismally.
You're changing the subject.
But that's where it starts at.
No, it's not where it starts at. I mean, you know, yes. You know, Reagan put Bill Bennett in charge of the Education Department. It was the first time in history that the Education Department had been led by a guy who was hostile to education. Our schools have been disintegrating ever since the beginning of the Reagan Revolution. Yes, but that has nothing to do with the minimum wage. You've got people with PhDs and master's degrees out there who are working in Starbucks. In fact, I know one of them. And you've got people working, and it's got nothing to do with education. Greg, thank you for the call. We're out of time here. But you're just, you know, if you want to win a minimum wage argument, hang on just a second. I'll tell you how to do it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Minimum wage has been with us since 1936. You want to win a minimum wage argument, name 1 year when the minimum wage went up and unemployment went up. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you and Priscilla in Smyrna, Tennessee. Hey, Priscilla, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. How you doing today?
Great. What's up?
Well, my concern.
Uh-oh. Priscilla, you still there? Priscilla, sometimes people hit the wrong button on their phone. It sounds like you did, or else your phone just croaked. Call us right back, okay, and let's see if we can get a line that works. Bobby, hopefully we don't have a problem on our end here. Bobby in Mountain View, California. Hey, Bobby, thanks for listening. What's up? You want to talk about Steve Jobs?
Yeah, you know, I keep on hearing Steve Jobs as the exemplar capitalist, but people always forget the America of his youth no longer exists. Offshoring didn't exist. There wasn't as much automation. You could still make something in your garage.
Yeah.
He had a higher likelihood of it succeeding. But that leads me to a bigger issue, right? This year, the meme is automation, right? Automation, mechanization. You know, I'm right here in the thick of it. They're creating in San Francisco a hamburger maker, fully automated, $20,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
People have been forced down on the job scale, right? You know, accountants, they can't find jobs because that's done in India. A lot of people don't know. When you use TurboTax, the back office is in India, right?
Right.
So it's a combination of tech and offshore. These people were forced, like you said, to become baristas in Starbucks.
Right.
And now they won't even be able to get jobs in McDonald's. When, what is it, a third of the country is on food stamps.
Right.
When half of the country makes less than $20,000 a year. You have to say that capitalism has failed this country.
I agree.
When 1% owns half the wealth in the world, that's yeah. just like an avalanche, a snowball growing larger and larger. It'll be 60% and 70%.
Yeah, this is what Mary What's-Her-Name, you know, warned us about back in the 19-teens when she invented the Monopoly game. You know, here's how it works, guys. Check it out.
It's exactly, and they call it the rentier, right?
Yeah, rentier, actually, yeah.
Rent, and it goes up every year. But
that's right.
We just don't keep up with that. It's scary what's happening. It's really, really scary.
It is, and this is, you know, this is why I wrote this last book about it. And again, not to pitch my books, but, you know, I really think that it's going to take some sort of massive awakening event in the United States. And history tells us that those massive awakening events happen about every 80 years. The last one was in the 1930. The one before that was in 1860. The one before that was in 1770. That these, you know, roughly 80 years apart, four generations. It takes about four generations for the people who remember the stupid mistakes that got us into these situations. The people who remember, for example, the Roaring Twenties and how Harding dropped the top income tax rate from 91% down to 25% in 1921. Those people are dead. It takes about 80 years for those people to die off, and then we make the same stupid mistakes all over again. And particularly in a society that is driven as much by capitalism as by anything else. I mean, capitalism is not a political system, but with Citizens United, capitalism has become a political system. And in other words, the capitalists have become major political actors in our supposedly constitutionally limited representative democratic republic. And so instead, what we've ended up with is an oligarchy and a constitutional monarchy, essentially. And we've got to do something about that. I think what we have to do about that is amend the Constitution. I don't know another solution. But, Bobby, you have identified the problem very, very well. Thank you for the call. Thank you for a very insightful call. We'll be right back. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Jordan in Albuquerque, New Mexico. You have a pithy observation about the Michigan Supreme Court case Dodge v. Ford, I'm guessing. Thanks for listening to KABQ. Jordan?
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the
air. Yeah, no, I had a different comment.
Oh, okay.
I had a question. I just wanted you to potentially elaborate. I'm a proponent for increasing the minimum wage,
right.
And from what I understand, that a lot of the same arguments against increasing the minimum wage were used against Henry Ford.
Yes.
He wanted to implement the minimum wage for factory workers, but
yes.
That, I thought, had an amazing boom on our economy. Why aren't we using that as an example of what that actually does to economies?
Excellent point. And where I thought you were going to go with that, Henry Ford raised the wage in his factories, in part due to union pressure, in part due to pressure from his wife, and in part due to pressure from his business partner, who went on to become a very progressive Michigan state senator, and maybe a U.S. senator, I don't recall. And Henry Ford personally was opposed to it, but he ended up taking credit for it for the rest of his life. He raised the wage from, as I recall, $1 a day, or maybe it was $1 a week, to $5 a day or $5 a week, whatever it was. And Horace Dodge, who owned a competing car company, sued him before the Michigan Supreme Court and said, Henry Ford is paying his workers too much, and now my workers are starting to get restless, and they're giving me a hard time, and his job as a businessman should be to make money, not to be a charity, not to be paying his workers well. And it went before the Michigan Supreme Court, and the Michigan Supreme Court ruled two things. They ruled, one, that yes, in fact, Dodge's argument was correct, that Henry Ford's Henry Ford's job was to make money, that a corporation's first mission is to provide for its stockholders. But two, Henry Ford's lawyers and his business partner went before the Michigan Supreme Court and argued that by paying his workers $5 a day, his workers then were catapulted into an income category where they could buy his cars. And as customers for his cars, they were creating demand and they were building his business. And that was making him money. And so it was making him more money than it cost him. And the Michigan Supreme Court agreed with that, ruled in Henry Ford's favor, even though they accepted Horace Dodge's argument. And you're absolutely right, Jordan. It's a great argument and we need to be using it more. Thank you for the call. Thanks for listening to KABQ there in Albuquerque. Lee in Missoula, Montana. Hey, Lee, what's up?
What's up? I was going to talk to Bernie Sanders. He let something get by him. One of my pet peeves in this world is the idea of the term limits.
Yeah, somebody called and asked Bernie a multi-piece question, and one part of it was term limits, and Bernie didn't address that. Is that your question, is my opinion on term limits, or do you want to share yours?
I'll share mine.
Okay, your phone is breaking up pretty badly, if you can speak.
Okay.
There you go.
I thought I got you on. Okay, can you hear me any better now?
Yeah, it sounds a lot better.
Okay, I'm a member of the board of directors of NARAL, and one of our major jobs is to re-educate all the new legislators. When you have a term limit, you lose the continuity of memory and continuity of the legislature.
Right, even what's called the institutional memory of the body, yes.
Yes, that's it. Well, that's the point I was trying to make on that.
Yeah, well, you made it very well. And this is, you know, people think that term limits are the solution. Term limits are a problem because, well, if you have term limits, if you have fast turnover of legislators, then who is it that the legislators turn to when they get into Congress or into the Senate or into a state Congress or, you know, House or Assembly or whatever? They have to turn to the permanent infrastructure, the permanent institution. And the permanent institution in a term limits environment is the lobbyists. And so you work for NARAL. I mean, it's a group that I agree with, but you're lobbyists. And so you're saying that you end up being the guys who educate them. And I'm spot on with you. And that's a very strong argument against term limits. Chuck in Denver, listening on AM 760. Tom, has his history wrong on the voting amendment?
Yeah, I was in high school in 1968, March of 1968.
Right.
I was a senior.
Yeah.
The 26th Amendment was first proposed, not proposed, first floated, that's the correct term, first floated in 1968, March 1968.
Oh, sure.
They wanted to see how many states would actually vote for this thing if it came out of Congress.
Right.
That took about 2.5 years. Midway through 1970, they finally got 3/4 of the states to approve it. That's why it went through Congress so quickly.
Uh-huh.
But it was done backwards. They first floated it to see how many states would approve it. They knew it would get out of Congress.
So it was done as an Article 5 amendment, the way that I'm proposing we do, reversing Citizens United. You got the states first, and then that forced Congress, and that's why it only took 3 months and a week in Congress. Thank you for that.
The other thing you got wrong was Barry McGuire started out with the New Christian Minstrels. The song Eve of Destruction came out in 1965.
Yeah, it came out in 65, but it hit number one on the Billboard list in 1970. You can go back and look.
That's because of
the war. Go back and look that up. And it hit number one in 1970 with Barry McGuire, and actually several other people had recorded it before him, because of this movement, in my opinion. And in fact, if you look at the, there's several different sites that cite Barry McGuire and Eve of Destruction as being one of the things that helped move the 26th Amendment through. So, you know, it happened in 70. It hit Billboard on, you know, number one Billboard in 1970, and in 71, March through July of 71 is when Congress took up and then passed the 26th Amendment. But I was unaware that in 68 it was running through state houses. Thank you very much for that, Chuck. Do you have a source for that? Any place I can look it up?
No. I was in high school in New York when it was first run.
And they were running it through the state legislature, you mean?
Right. They ran it through all the state legislatures, and they found out that more than 3/4, way more than 3/4, would have approved it if it came out of Congress.
Right. Oh, wait a minute. So it wasn't passed by 3/4 of the state legislatures first?
No. They didn't try to pass it. No. They
All right.
All the states.
It's just that they convinced Congress that well, that's what Move to Amend is doing right now with these non-binding amendments. They got in 23 states already, 22 or 23 states, to pass non-binding resolutions, saying, yes, we would support such an amendment. So I think we're doing that same work now, Chuck. And I David Cobb thinks it's going to be 5 years. I think it's going to be two or three. Anyhow, coming up tomorrow, Charlie Crist, former Republican governor of the great state of Florida, now running as a Democrat, will be here. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIX, Wix.com. Everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. ITM Trading. America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com. You say it, they will build it. Granger, for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.